Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison for our meeting for October. Our speaker today hails from Eau Claire. Is retired from the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction and does volunteer database development for a number of local nonprofit organizations and some profit, I guess.
Yep.
As I introduced him when he spoke here in December, he says he has more opinions than any 10 people should be legally allowed to have, but he's trying to fix that by giving them away as fast as possible. So, welcome, Richard Russell.
Thank you. Today we will be talking about Justice and the Common Good, which is based on this book by Michael J. Sandel called Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? And this is a distillation of some of the material that appears in a course taught by Professor Sandel at Harvard University. It is probably the best attended course ever offered at Harvard. The reason behind that is because he deals with real world situations and says, what's the right thing to do in this situation? And of course, he picks the sorts of stories that are sort of head scratchers. You say, well, it's hard to say what the right thing to do is. And then he uses those stories as a springboard for subjecting the story to some sort of analysis and said, well, how would we go about sorting out? What's the right thing to do here? What standards would we apply? What traditions are we coming from? What considerations should we have? What facts do we need to examine? And he runs his students through this course. It's a semester-long course and is inordinately popular. The last time he offered it before this book was published, he had 1,200 students sign up for it. And the enrollment of Harvard is not that large. One of the things he alludes to in the book is something which is a prominent school of thought in American philosophy these days, based on the book of John Rawls called A Theory of Justice. And this Rawlsian concept of justice has been ascendant, certainly in liberal political thought, for most of the second half of the 20th century and into the current century. Sandel contends that Rawls was okay for his time, but there were certain things he failed to take into account, certain considerations that we seem to, in his estimation, have grown beyond. And that's what he talks about in his book, where he lays out three main threads of philosophical thought as to what constitutes justice, and said Rawls is the exemplar of one of these, but we're going to look at, in his case, he says we're going to look at an expansion of this, because Rawls tended to be an individualist. And Sandel says, well, individualism is one aspect of justice, but it's not necessarily the only one. We should consider various communitarian ideals as well and pay more attention to the common good rather than the good of the individual, which is what Rawls promoted. So we'll be talking about a lot of that as we go along. Before we get too deeply into this, I want to make sure that everybody has a chance to take a copy of this. I am here partly as a representative of Atheists and Agnostics of Wisconsin. This is one of our little publications called the Sacred Book of Cush. It's sort of a very brief parody of the Bible. You can carry it around with you and wave it at fundamentalists if they brace you about why you should believe in their book rather than some other book. So feel free to avail yourself of a copy. As you'll discover, it folds down very nicely into credit card size, so you can keep it in your wallet, which is a handy place to have it. Unlike a lot of college courses, we're going to start you off at the beginning of this session with an exam. Where, if you do this in college, they would save the exam for the end of the course. Please take a pen.
Can you use your own pen?
You can use your own pen, yeah. I just want to make sure everybody had one. And let's see, I'm going to figure out how to divide the room. Let's say right here, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name.
Richard.
Richard. Well, what a great name. You know, why would I forget that? We'll take everybody from Richard around to Bob here, and you will be the red team. And we'll take the two folks in the back there and wrap everybody around this side, and you'll be the blue team, okay? What I'm going to do is I'm going to pass out four sheets of paper, and I would like you to keep them face down or blank side up. And the red team over here is going to get a blue sheet first. And the blue team over here is, I guess, to do this properly, I should say the blue team is going to get the blue sheet first. And the red team will get the green sheet first. Once you've got your sheet of paper in front of you face down, continue to pass it around to the other people, and they will put the second sheet on top of the first sheet. I don't know if that was clear enough. Everybody from here will have your blue sheet face down and a green sheet on top of it. Everybody from here around to here will have a green sheet face down and a blue sheet on top of it. Okay, hope that works.
And they're going to pass one another?
Pretty complicated.
And you're going to pass each other, yeah. So here you go, blue sheet face down, green sheet face down. We'll find out how well this works.
Are they passed beyond our section?
Yes, the blue sheets will keep on going that way and the green sheets will keep on going this way.
Do we need to mark anything as red or blue?
Do you need to what?
Do we need to mark anything as red or blue?
No, I was just picking random. I should have called them probably A and B since the papers have different colors. And please keep them face down. Don't look, no peeking, no peeking. Yo, in the back there, no peeking. Hey, woo, no peeking.
I see from over here what's on the blue sheet already.
Okay, and then the two packets of paper will cross right there. You people all put green sheets on top of blue sheets. You people all put blue sheets on top of green sheets. Don't peek at this one either.
Don't make it more than
setting
an example.
You know, this is actually going to be an anonymous test, so don't put your names on. As soon as everybody's got that, we're going to have edition number two, which is going to be a pink sheet is going to come around. You're going to put the pink sheet face down on top of those two sheets. Here you go. And following shortly behind that will be the yellow sheets. You can put the yellow sheet face down on top of the pink sheet.
Okay. Are they all the same?
They're all the same, correct.
You couldn't tell without asking.
Well, that's because they're face down. I mean, how would you know? From the side, you could see they all look the same. Okay, and here's the yellow sheet for on top of the pink sheet.
Now the exam is whether we can.
Yeah, the exam is whether you can tell the colors apart.
And follow instructions.
You pass the exam, you have them in the right
order. All right. So you've got these sheets in front of you, face down. What we're going to do is have pen in hand. We're going to have you turn the, when I say so, we're going to have you turn the yellow sheet over, and you're going to have 90 seconds to come up with answers to the question on that side. So take your time to read it, think about it a little bit, and I'll give you a little countdown as we get close to the 90 second mark. Yellow sheet first, ready, turn it over. 30 seconds left. I see many people haven't quite written stuff down yet, so I'm going to give you an extra 30 seconds. Okay, see, many folks are still thinking, so I mean, it's a bit, I guess I overestimated the speed with which this part could be processed. I'm going to give you another minute on account of it. I just want to make sure that we aren't rushing you too much. I was an analyst, policy analyst, budget analyst.
you weren't a teacher.
No. Okay, sailing down to the last 15 seconds. Time to wrap her up. Get off the fence, make that last decision, write it down. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, stop. Turn that sheet over. So you're done with that sheet for now. Okay, next what we're going to do is we're going to whip over the, and don't do it yet, we're going to have you turn over the pink sheet and spend 20 seconds reading it. And then we're going to have you turn over again. Ready? Go. 30 seconds, I should have said.
There's no question.
There is no question yet. Hang tight. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, turn the pink sheet over, please. Now we're going to have you, don't do it yet, but when I give you the word, I'm going to have you turn over the next sheet in your collection. For the people on this side, that's going to be the green sheet. For the people on this side, it's going to be the blue sheet. You get 30 seconds to make your decision and make your mark. 30 seconds, ready?
We're done with the pink.
Yeah. Ready? Yeah, we're done with the pink. So the next one's the green sheet for this group, the blue sheet for this group. Ready? Turn.
Can you add another choice?
No. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, stop. Turn that sheet over. You now have one remaining sheet in your collection of goodies. It should be the blue sheet for this group and the green sheet for this group. It's going to be the same deal. When I give you the word, turn it over. You got 30 seconds to make your decision. Ready? Go. Stop. Turn that sheet over. Okay, that concludes the final exam for this course. Everybody on this side, pass your papers up this way. Doesn't matter what order they're in, you feel free to scramble them. It's an anonymous test. Everybody on this side, pass your papers up this direction. Okay. People on this side got the green sheet first. I can't remember. Which one did come first? The green one and then the blue one?
We dealt with the blue before we dealt with
you. Dealt with the blue before the green. You dealt with the green before the blue. All right. So here's what we're going to do. Bob, I would like you to whip on through here. Tell me again, you dealt with the blue before the green, right? Mm-hmm. And what the blue one says is, do you push the fat man?
So just the blue sheets?
Yeah. So Bob, what I'd like you to do is, three possible things we could have on here are yes, no, and no answer. So I want you to just whip on through the blue sheets here, telling me what the response was, yes or no, okay. And I'll just make tally marks, and then put the blue sheets off to the side.
Okay.
Was
go.
There a question?
No. 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 No, with a comment. No. No. I guess that's it.
Okay. And I would like to put somebody to the same task over on this side.
We're doing green and blue.
We're doing the blue, for you guys, we're doing the blue sheets first.
Okay.
So just whip on through, separating out the blue sheets as you come to them, and tell me what response you get.
That's a no. Another no. A no. No. One yes. No. No. No.
The bottom page, and that's mine, and it's a no.
Blank.
It's a no.
Okay, now we're going to do the same sort of deal with the green sheets, starting over here with Bob. Just go through and give me the results of the green sheet, which is, do you throw the lever?
There's one more no.
One more no.
That I missed.
What was the green one again?
The green one is, do you throw the lever? So, Bob, give me the answers.
Yes. No. No. Yes. No answer. Yes. 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 Yes.
Is that the last of them?
Yep.
Okay, Susan, same story over here, the green sheets.
Okay. No. Yes. 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 Blank. Yes. No. And a yes.
And that's the end of them?
Yep.
Okay. Hang on to those stacks of goodies there, because we're going to be going through the yellow sheets in just a little bit. This exercise is one that was put together as part of a series of questions, dilemmas, ethical dilemmas, and given to people to find out what their line of thinking was with regard to problems like this. And you'll notice that, and the reason I had one side of the room do the fat man question first and the lever question second, and the other side of the room do it the other way, is so that whichever one you got first would not prejudice you with regard to the one you got next. The results that you see here are remarkably similar to what happens if you give this question or questions like it to people all around the world, different cultures, different ages, different sexes, different religions, different cultural backgrounds, different ethnicities. Almost all the time, they're perfectly willing to say, yes, you can throw the lever. You know, as you see here, we got six yes on each side, two no on each side, and one NA on each side. But they're unwilling to push the fat man off. Here's 9, 0, and 0 on this side, 7, 1, and 1 on this side.
Actually, people, that one at the bottom was that I would not throw the fat man.
Okay, well, it was reported as a blank,
yeah,
so that's,
well, I told her before
that's the result we
got.
But the thing I want to emphasize here is that it didn't seem to matter a whole lot which one of these questions you got first. You know, and we're testing to find out if one of these prejudices you in favor of or against committing an action. You know, if you're inclined to commit an action here, does that incline you to commit an action here? If you're not inclined to commit an action here, does that mean you're not inclined to commit one here? You notice the order in which you got the questions didn't seem to matter. Your sex doesn't matter. Your age doesn't matter. Most things don't matter. These seem to be sort of innate reactions that people have to this kind of ethical dilemma. This is one of a series of ethical dilemmas that are posed in what's called the, can't remember the name of it, fit test, bit test, something like that. It's a series of questions that pose stories like this and ask you what you would do. The explanation for it that I've come up with, and you know, I'm sure it's probably not original with me, but I haven't actually encountered it somewhere else, deals with evolution. If you think of a timeline like this, where we have the present here, and then like a million years ago, a million years before the present, back here, this is about the first time we had critters walking the planet who were arguably human, you know, who fit the qualification of what we call genus Homo. like 500,000 years ago, and maybe like 100,000 years ago. And then down here would be like 10,000 years ago. This little stretch right here represents everything we know about human history. About 10,000 years ago was the dawn of agriculture, the dawn of civilization, the dawn of reading and writing, and it represents 1% of the lifespan of Homo sapiens, or Homo, genus Homo, on this planet. For the other 99% of our time on this planet, which is the time during which our genetic composition was formed, because, you know, it took like nearly a million years to get to this point. During that time, we lived in groups of 20 to 50. You knew everybody in your tribe. Who was the thing that you had to worry about the most? It was the tribe almost exactly like you, who lived on the other side of the valley, across the hill, around the bend, over the mountain, because inasmuch as they were almost exactly like you, they were your primary competitors for the available resources. They were the ones that wanted the best grazing lands, the best hunting territory, the water, you name it. And so the people that you were most accustomed to dealing with, and you've heard that old phrase, it takes a village to raise a child, well, that was the village, is the tribe that you lived in. And so we're very good at dealing on an interpersonal basis with the sort of folks that we have grown up with, and we know them all by face and name. Everybody worth knowing, you know personally. And anybody that looks kind of like you, but you don't recognize, they're probably the enemy. Growing up in this kind of environment led to the genetic development of people who have predispositions as to what they think is acceptable conduct and what they think is not. 99% of our genetic history was developed during this time. We have since then come up with what we call rationality, which provides an overlay on top of this, where we think things through and say, well, why did we do that? It is my contention that most of this, and you know, I'm not alone in this contention, it's my contention that most of this is simply a post hoc rationalization. You just sort of overlay a justification. You've intellectualized what you're inclined to do anyway. If you're familiar with Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, he says the same thing. Uses the example of a quarterback in the NFL, drops back to pass. He doesn't take the time to analyze who's going which direction and who's likeliest to be open. He gets a feel for it, and he reacts. And you have to do that quickly because you got about 3 seconds to get the pass off before some gargantuan behemoth smashes you into the ground. So you have to be able to react quickly using your gut instinct. Pretty much all of philosophy is an effort to get beyond that and say, well, let's think our way through. Why did we do these things? And one of the drawbacks to that approach is no matter what system of philosophy you come up with, you always end up with a result from whatever principles you've established that somehow or other just doesn't sit well with you. For example, you have the concept of liberty. You know, a lot of people like liberty, but it ends up so that if you allow people to have whatever liberty they want, that some people end up just inordinately rich and some people end up desperately poor. And that just sort of rubs us the wrong way. You know, it follows the principles of liberty, the intellectual principle of liberty, just fine. But it just seems like an unfair result. And so it seems like it's unjust, because the subject of this talk here and the subject of this book is justice. How just is it that of the worldly wealth of a society like the United States, that the top 1% of the population owns 60% of the wealth? Just doesn't strike, and that's probably an exaggeration, but they own a lot of it. Just strikes a lot of people as not being a fair outcome from what is essentially a libertarian viewpoint, where you're free to, where the markets are free, where you can trade money, buy and sell to your heart's content, and value is placed on you as a human being based on how well you do in this kind of economy. An alternative to that is the concept of utilitarianism, the most good for the most people. Well, there's a flaw to that as well. It turns out that that if you allow for the most good for the most people, you can have a situation where the majority of people, in fact, perhaps the vast majority of people in a culture, really want to discriminate against a despised minority. If you say, well, what's the greatest good for the greatest number? if that's your guiding principle, that shouldn't be an undesirable outcome. You say, okay, well, so we're going to persecute the Jews. So what? There's not very many of them. You know, and the rest of us feel a lot happier knowing that we can take it out on them. We've got a scapegoat. It just makes me feel good at night to know that I've figured out what the source of all my problems is. You know, screw them. Well, that's one of the outcomes of utilitarianism carried to, you know, I wouldn't even necessarily say it's a logical extreme. That's just an aspect of utilitarianism. And this also seems to rub people the wrong way. They say, oh, you know, any system that produces that as a result can't be a particularly good system. John Rawls thought he had kind of gotten around this by coming up with what he called the veil of ignorance. And his proposition was that the ideal society, the one that is most just, is the one that anybody would create if they knew they were going to be placed at some random location in that society. You wouldn't know going in who you were going to be. And if you want to get metaphysical about it, you can think, well, you're a disembodied soul waiting to be born into a body in this society. What sort of society would you like to have it be in order that, you know, your life will be a reasonably pleasant one once you're born? Because you don't know who you're going to be. You don't know if you're going to be the Jew that Hitler kills or if you're going to be Hitler. You don't know going in. So what sort of society would be the ideal society to have under those circumstances, assuming that you start off with this veil of ignorance? And we call this, or at least I've been referring to it, as theoretical libertarianism, distinguished from actual libertarianism, where you're free to act as you wish, given your starting position in life. And theoretical libertarianism of John Rawls gives rise to a situation where it's not like you have perfect equality of everything, but you have a good deal of leveling going on. That if somebody is inordinately wealthy, they're required to give back to the rest of society to help the people who are less fortunate than themselves. The devil, as always, is in the details. Rawls was, first to admit this. He said, cases are hard. You know, it's easy to state general principles, but when you get down to cases, what should be the proper tax rate for a country, for example? You don't want to destroy incentive. You don't want to destroy initiative. At the same time, you want to make sure that people get a fair shake. So he granted right up front that this was not necessarily an easy thing to administer. Let us turn our attention now to the yellow sheets that we had here, and we'll talk a little bit about how that works its way out. So Bob, I'm going to have you whip on through the sheets there, and let's just start with let's see, what's the easiest way to do this? Let's just start with question one. You read me off a number and I'll do tally marks. This is just question number one.
250, 100, 0, 300, 100, 1,000. 100 or 0. 100.
I'm going to give him credit for the first answer.
0. That's it.
Okay. And Susan, likewise. And actually, it doesn't actually matter which side of the room did this because you weren't required to do it in one order or the other. So
100, 1,000, 200, didn't answer, 100, 25, 100, 1,000, 0.
Okay. Well, this is particularly sloppy record keeping on my part. The reason we're looking at this is not so much because there is a right answer or a wrong answer, but because it reflects to some extent what we call Kohlberg's stages of moral development. This is adduced by Lawrence Kohlberg, and he said that gradually through time, people will, let's see, this is question number one. gradually through time, people will come up with different methods of making decisions like this. And his technique for describing these, or his systemology for describing these, and I'm going to do this from the bottom up, because it was based on his idea that you go through these stages as you get older, so it's dependent on age. The first level he had here, stage one, was based on obedience. And this is what little kids have. They say, if I'm going to get spanked for doing this, I'm not going to do it. And that's their primary orientation for why they make a decision to do this or that. Second one is self-interest. What's in it for me? And we all know kids are famously egotistical. So you get that one. Stage three is interpersonal accord and peer pressure. Stage four is authority, social order. Stage five, we're getting up into the esoteric here, Kohlberg's contention that most people get stuck here at the authority, social order stage. But stage five is social contract and stage six is universal, and I got to mention the word universal eventually since I'm in the universalist church here, universal ethical principles. Now, Kohlberg grouped these particular stages in three categories, which he referred to as pre-conventional, these two right here, pre-conventional. And I don't think pre-conventional is a particularly descriptive term, so I refer to this as the personal. Then the conventional, which I refer to as the social. And then what he calls the post-conventional, which I call the global. It is suggested that if you get up to the level where you're concerned with the social contract, that is, what is a reasonable expectation for somebody given the norms of society, and you're willing to allow for exceptions to the norm based on, say, conscientious objection, that in fact, this bears a striking resemblance to self-interest, which is what a little kid would do and say, well, I want to do this because I want to do this. I don't need any other justification. It's good for me. Screw you. And somebody up here who says, I'm aware of what the societal expectations are, but I don't agree with them, you know, might be taken to be acting at the stage two level. It is